It's also simply energy. So what I encourage you all to do is pass everything you do through the lens of, can I push the gas pedal just a little bit harder? And on the other end of that, some of you need to know, I need to learn when to apply the brake. And so I was very blessed to last night go see Dr. Andrew Huberman speak live, and it was a phenomenal talk. And one of the biggest takeaways I had from it, and this is one of my favorite things, why him and I get along very well. He basically said, I want you to push it as hard as you possibly can during the day, as long as you can sleep at night. He's like, you should be pushing the gas pedal as hard as you possibly can during the day. Take on as much stress as you possibly can during the day, as long as you can sleep at night. And another guy who's been a big influence in my life, Greg Roscoff, you guys listen to my podcast. He's also got a similar thing. Every time I would leave his office, he'd be like, I want you to leave with an S on your chest. And he goes, now go break it. Every time I'd go, he'd like fix something. He goes, now go break it. And I'm like, my kind of people. You know, some people are like, oh, you got to slow down. I'm like, no, don't fucking slow down. Go faster. But make sure you know how to use the steering wheel and the brakes. And so our job here at Muscle Intelligence is not only to give you a bigger gas pedal, it's to also teach you how to use the steering wheel and the brakes. And so today, Coach Greg is going to take the floor, and I'll give you a little intro about Coach Greg. Coach Greg joined us in about February this year under the guise of he was going to become our internal nutritionist, being very highly recommended. And he's grown to be so much more than that. He's grown to be a leader on our team, an integral part of our team, and a resource that every single person in our team, client and coach, go to for nutrition information, for functional medicine information. And ultimately, one of the things that I have to boast about Greg is that every single person he's working with is getting exceptional results. And now usually, like even me, like it's not 100% of people, right? Like it's, but some people like drag their feet and they make excuses, and sometimes you got to chase them up. And Greg has an incredible track record of results. And results doesn't just mean, hey, we're going to put a ton of muscle on you. That's one facet. That doesn't just mean we're going to lose a bunch of fat. That's a second facet, but it's all of it, right? So you're going to move well. You're going to feel great. You're going to build muscle. You're going to lose fat. And in the short amount of time, whatever that time duration is to working with Greg, I believe 100% of people have been just completely over the moon and ecstatic with his ability to coach. I only say that to kind of set the floor for Greg's going to do a brief presentation for us now on fat loss principles, how to optimize your ability to burn fat. I trust his knowledge on this. Him and I have gone back and forth on this. I trust his knowledge on this probably more than anyone on the planet, or at least as much as anyone on the planet. And I'm going to apologize in advance if you can't understand a word that he says. He's doing his best to stop with this damn Irish accent, but we love Greg. He's a gentleman. And so, ladies or gentlemen, I give you Coach Greg Foley.
Thanks, Ben. Very humbling. Much appreciated. Good evening, everybody. I hear we have new people on the call. Just raise your hand so I know who you are. See you guys. Devin, see you. Jordan, great. Lovely to see new people on. John, I see you as well. If, as we go through this process, lose fat people without giving up the lifestyle. It's the dream, right? So today, what I'm going to take you guys through, we're going to go through, first of all, what fat loss looks like when people always talk about like the calories in, calories out side of the model, right? So people will say, eat less, move more. And don't get me wrong, yes, we cannot ignore calories. But also what we'll touch on as we get a little bit further into this presentation is we'll look at the physiology of how fat loss actually occurs at a cellular level and some of the hormones that might be at play. And I would hope that you guys get some information out of this that you're probably missing when you look at trying to achieve optimal fat loss. Now, I'll run this through a presentation for you guys as well, but important, I want to make this as interactive as possible. So I'll be pulling aside at certain stages to ask you guys questions. I would love if you can give answers to that. So you can either shout them out, put them in the chat, do whatever you think is best. And we'll try and get as much of this information, we'll try and get as much out of this conversation as we can. At the very end, I'm more than happy to hang around for as long as you guys need to answer any questions. Fat loss, although in its simplest form, is really basic, but it becomes very nuanced at the same time. So some of your questions I may not be able to answer directly, but I will always go away and try and find the answer for you. Okay. Let me just share my screen. Oop, so looking for it. Now, there we go. So the science of fat loss, what are we missing directly? So what are you missing from your program now that you can integrate tomorrow that will improve your fat loss results? Okay. What are we trying to learn from this? So we'll talk about the energy in versus energy out model. We'll touch on the physiology of fat loss, and we'll touch on some of the applications of the principles that we discuss. So we'll try and take one thing, two things out of this that you can try and implement tomorrow to speed up fat loss. All right. Now, we'll start with energy in versus energy out. First of all, guys, it's always a good question I like to ask people. So you can put it in the chat. Do we think all calories are created equal, right? So let's talk about calories. You can think of that as a unit of energy is generally what we think about. So put in the chat, are all calories created equal? Come on, Lewis has his up. So we're getting predominantly no's, and I'm willing to argue this point, right? Absolutely not, right? Love it, right? So everyone's got a clear perspective of whether all calories are created equal. Aha! Thank you, Mats. I would argue the point that all calories are exactly, thank you, Greg. All calories are exactly the same when we look at it as simply as that, a source of energy. So people will argue the point like steak versus jelly babies, right? Yes, they react differently within the body, but a calorie as, think of a calorie just as a measurement of energy. How it responds when you put it into an open system like the human body will determine its effect. But a calorie is just that. And think about it just in that way. Like we said, when you eat something from, and it also there's so much context to it. So if I gave, think of someone on the call who's very lean and strong, right? If I gave them jelly beans after they train, it will respond very differently to someone who's 50 pounds overweight if I gave them jelly beans first thing in the morning. But that is what happens when you put something into an open system. So I would argue the point that all calories are the same. They just respond differently in the body. So we'll think of that as like rule. We can argue the point at the end. We can think about that as rule one, right? But this, when you put it into a closed system, so this is the equation that they would use when you look at engineering, for example. Closed system, no energy can be destroyed, it can only be changed or converted to something else. Okay. And that's generally the idea that people think of in the body. There's always nuance to this, though, right? So when we think about the energy inside of things, just think of it as the food you put in your mouth. Okay. Now, that can be affected by certain things. When we look at like the gut microbiome in certain people, we can actually extract more calories from food in certain circumstances. So a dominance of what are called firmicutes in certain people, you can get an extra 10 to 15% extraction of calories from food, but it's not all it's, but generally speaking, you just want to think of it as the food that you're taking in. Okay. That's the easy side of things. When we look at energy out, so where does our energy output come from? So again, guys, put it in the chat. What things do we think affect the energy outside of equation. And I'm sure you guys will put in loads of different stuff and they'll probably fit into the categories that we're going to speak about. So what affects how many calories we burn? We know how many we take in. What affects the calories that go out? Good one, actually. So being alive is actually, yeah, one of the primary ones. Living, breathing, moving, yeah. Metabolism. Sweet. Okay. So absolutely. The dominant one that's going to determine how much energy we expend is going to be basal metabolic rate. And people will generally say when they can't lose weight, my metabolism is broken. And this debate I used to have with people, and I used to turn around and say, BMR doesn't, it changes slightly as we age, but it hasn't changed through our ancestry, actually. And it's a post I'm going to put up in the Facebook group on Friday. There's recent research that's come out that's kind of mentioned that actually every 10 years since the 1900s, males in particular, our BMR has been slowly dropping. Very minusculely drops in temperature, but to a possible buildup of like 100 to 150 calories a day less that we burn as a BMR, the mechanism I'll discuss on Friday. But there's four things that will generally determine our BMR. So what can we influence most? Age, right? We can talk about biological versus chronological, right? So the health age that we are versus the actual numerical age that we are, right? But won't get into that too much. Sex, can't really determine. Well, there's arguments about that now as well. Hormones, we can influence slightly, but it's going to be one of those things where it's not going to be the main thing that we try and influence straight off the bat. Muscle mass is a big one that we can influence. And it's why people always talk about maintaining muscle mass while you drop body fat is huge in determining what your BMR will look like when you lose all the body fat. So yes, eat less, move more, but the type of move more actually is important to long-term weight loss success. So take that shit stuff into consideration. So with hormones, you can think of stuff like testosterone will regulate it, thyroid in particular will regulate it, the stress hormones will regulate it as well. We'll talk about hormones a little bit later. And here's the other things, right? So I know people put in sleep, not directly, but I get what you're getting at. So you've got thermic effects of activity, right? So structured exercise that we do doesn't lead into fat loss as much as we would want unless you do lots of it. So like marathon runners, yeah, for sure. People who are pounding the pavement all the time, people who are doing 2-a-day sessions, 3-a-day sessions, yeah. Thermic effective activity will affect it. But in for the generalized weekend warriors like most of us are, who are training 4 or 5 times a week, not that much, right? Now, nuance to that as well. Thermic effect of food actually plays, it can be influenced quite directly by us. So when we look at the macronutrients that we consume, right, how much of that gets burnt in actual digestion? So when we look at protein, it's 25 to 30%. It's pretty good, right? Carbohydrates, 10 to 15, fats, 1 to 3%. So protein, of all the, it's primary in Latin, right? It is the most important macronutrient generally for the vast majority of us. It's not just the muscle mass. It's not just the immune system. It's not just all the enzymes in your body. It actually helps us to lower the amount of calories we consume from the food that we eat. It's a big one. Now, NEAT is the last one. NEAT means non-exercise activity thermogenesis, right? Basically means unconscious movement. So we all know that person. I'll use an anecdote here. I remember working with a guy once upon a time who could never stop moving. I remember having to go to a health and safety or a first aid course with him, and the kid just didn't move naturally, really. Sorry, Josh. Thermic effect of activity. So think about that as structured exercise, the exercise you plan to do, right? And then NEAT is unconscious movement. So you see these guys that naturally really lean, that just move all the time. So this kid literally didn't stop moving. And he was lean as hell and he struggled to put on muscle mass. He had to eat a lot of calories in order to do so. So those people actually, like Ben was talking about the mitochondria within the cell. That's a real negative adaptation if we were to go back historically when food wasn't readily available. You don't want to waste energy. Right? Whereas now it's become quite positive. So what happens within the mitochondria, it becomes porous. You get these little gaps in it. So when it's trying to create energy, a lot of that energy dissipates as heat. So we lose some of the energy. So the mitochondria has to work even harder to make it. So these people tend to be naturally really lean. So when people wonder why certain people tend to be really lean while others don't, this is one of the major factors is NEAT. Now, so it's that easy. That's fat loss for you. Done. You can all go home. Not quite, right? So this is where stuff gets a little bit nuanced. And we can see how resting metabolism is probably the biggest factor in terms of total daily energy expenditure. But what happens to the body? We'll use me for an example, right? And you guys can put this in the chat. What would happen if you knew what my total daily energy expenditure was exactly to the calorie, and it was 3,000, and you took 100 calories away from me, what would happen? Chuck it in the chat. Doesn't matter what the answer is. Let's just see what people think. Come on. With 100 calories gone, I'd probably be all right, Russell. Slow weight loss, nothing, not much. Slow weight loss, lose weight maybe. Weight loss. Right. Dominic, probably spot on. Nothing will happen. Chances are, now obviously some people, they will lose weight, but we've got this heart, well, it's a really smart mechanism within our body, right? But nowadays, where food is omnipresent, it's ubiquitous, we can find it anywhere. We can reach out and find 5,000 calories straight off the bat, normally within 20 paces of where we are, right? So now it's not a good adaptation, but we have this thing that's called adaptive thermogenesis. So the body will regulate up and down to try and maintain homeostasis or stay the same, okay? So if I drop 100 calories, it'll probably do nothing. If I ate 3,100 calories, it'll probably do nothing. My body weight will still fluctuate within 2-ish pounds, okay? So where does this come from? When we try and drop body fat, the body will naturally try and close that gap through adaptive thermogenesis. Think of this ancestrally. We don't fear getting over fat anymore. But we go back generations within certain populations and we had famine, right? So you can look at the Indians during World War II. You can look at the Irish 150 years ago. So 5-6 generations ago, my family had it. We can think of the story, like the Dutch hunger study was an amazing example of this. So during World War II, when the Nazis blockaded Holland, there was massive famine, massive starvation. They followed them for generations, two generations afterwards. And their children tended to be much more inclined to obesity, and the women were much more inclined to get PCOS. It's called polycystic ovary syndrome, where they deposit fat really well, okay? So we're not necessarily afraid of gaining fat really effectively, but we still fear famine. So the body will try and conserve energy. And I'm going to give 2 points. I'm going to give 2 points to anyone who can get this right. There were the four things that we spoke about. So we had BMR, thermic effective activity, thermic effective food, and non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Which of those components will play the biggest role in adaptive thermogenesis? So what will try and close that gap the most? Gabe, Joshua, good answers. Keep going. BMW. I was zooming out, Jimmy. Yeah. So Actually, a lot of smart guys on this call. Normally, when I do these in front of people, people tend not to know, but you guys seem to know. NEAT is what will close the gap. The body will unconsciously move less in order to try and conserve energy. Let's look at this to the extreme, right? If you get someone who's preparing for a bodybuilding show and is walking around at 4 and 5% body fat, right? They basically have to be cattle prodded to be made move. They blink slower. They speak slower. Everything is in the attempt to conserve energy. Okay. So NEAT is going to determine how much weight you lose when you go into a caloric deficit. Now, BMR will get affected once you start to get into real deep calorie deficits. All right. So like hormones will get affected, muscle mass will start to get affected. But as in that initial weight loss point, if you're trying to get from 25% to 15%, it's going to be NEAT. People don't buy into the idea that steps will make them lose weight. So like if NEAT's going to be the problem, as a coach, I'm not going to tell people to fidget more. That kind of thing is obsessive. I'm going to tell them to go out, although it's active, like you're consciously thinking about the movement. I get that. But step count can massively offset that. Okay. So getting out, like when your coach is telling you to get, like to get up from 4,000 steps, to get 8, to get 10, yeah, it's time consuming. But I've had clients in the past, and there's one anecdote I'm going to tell you, which sits with me to this day. I had a gentleman, this is years ago when I was working in the gym. He was pushing 70, type 2 diabetic, about 70, 80 pounds overweight. I sat in front of him, told me he's type 2 diabetic, and I love the nuance of all this, right? So I'm reaching out. I'm like, right, you know what we got to do? We got to get you keto. We got to get you to a ketogenic diet. I know all these supplements we're going to take. We're going to get your blood sugar under control. We're going to track your blood sugar. He was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This guy didn't even know what a protein was, right? Massively overshot it. And all he could do for me at the beginning, I was like, do you like, and I was like a little bit dejected when he said he wouldn't be able to follow any of my cool stuff. So I turned around to him and said, what can you do for me? And he goes, I just retired. I love walking and I'll drink protein shakes. And I was like, right. So we're going to do double scoop of protein for breakfast, double scoop of protein for lunch, along with your meals. And we're going to see how your walking has an effect. He took the step count from about 4,000 to about 20,000 straight away. And the weight literally melted off him. He lost stones of weight. Got off insulin that he was on at that stage. Turned around to me and goes, oh, Greg, you changed my life. And I said, but you started walking more. Don't get me wrong, I still use this picture and put it online to say how great I was, but that's marketing, right? But that's how effective step count can be as one of these things. So it's not to be ignored. So when you understand that equation, you can start to influence it in certain ways. So you can think activity, you can think higher protein intake, you can think muscle mass and understand how they play into this equation. Okay? Now you get into some of the fancy stuff as well. So how do we fit physiologically? What happens at the cell when we try and burn body fat? Don't look at this and go, oh God, right? We'll explain this as easiest way that we can. That's how you spell lipolysis. I spelled that wrong. Damn. Anyway. So this is a fat cell. People look at fat cells and they're like, oh, they're terrible things. They're not. People once upon a time thought these were just benign fat-storing sacks that triglycerides used to go in and used to make us look bad and feel bad. It's not the case, right? They're hormonal entities. They release hormones. They accept signals from hormones. And they're influenced by the hormones within our body. So whether we release them, whether we store them, they'll be based on the energy state and the hormones that we have available to influence them. Okay? So when we are in when it's energy scarcity, so when there's not much energy available in the body, the central nervous system in the brain will send signals out to release certain hormones to influence a fat cell. And the main two that will do that are glucagon and epinephrine. Others ones do as well. Like I said, growth hormone will do this. It's just not as widely available and used for this process, unless you're taking it exogenously, right? Then it can influence it more. But remember with lipolysis, this isn't the burning fat stage. This is just taking fat out of fat cells and putting them into the bloodstream. So these two, think of glucagon, right? And think about it. Glucose is gone. So when we're in low glucose state, low energy state, glucagon will come and knock on the cell, the fat cell, and say, I need you to liberate triglycerides and fatty acids and put them out into the bloodstream. So it does two, it's called cyclical AMP. These are the enzymes that actually cleave. Because when we look at what a triglyceride or a fat is, it's a glycerol backbone with three fatty acids hanging on it. So these enzymes will just come and cleave those fatty acids and put them out into the bloodstream. Okay? That is pretty much it. Now, that's how we liberate fat. 2 points for anybody who can tell me what hormone puts all this, and puts a stop to all this. Quick. Well done. Insulin, the dreaded insulin. So insulin, this happens, so people will generally then jump on and say, therefore insulin is bad. That's not necessarily the case, right? Insulin is effective at doing lots of different things, but people look at it generally as the storage hormone. So they'll say, insulin is bad. When I eat insulin, I stop liberating fat. Yes, insulin tends to go up when we're in the fed state. Chronically elevated insulin will stop this process from occurring. But let me try and explain something else. If insulin is so bad, it's also used to help us push glucose into muscle cells. It helps us partition nutrients. It does much more than just block off fat cells from releasing their fatty acids. But here's a caveat as well. Who knows what happens to the cell when we become insulin resistant? We always hear about that, like pre-diabetes, diabetes, insulin resistance, these horrible things. What happens to the cell? What happens to a fat cell if it doesn't listen to insulin? Okay, anecdote, right? You can think about it like this. It rejects the uptake of trigs. Not quite, it's funny, right? What generally happens when a fat cell becomes, so think about insulin resistance in this way, right? My wife's asleep, so she can't hear me, right? When my wife is in my ear over something, right? She'll keep telling me the same thing over and over again, a job that I don't want to do, and I don't do it. Inevitably, I just stop listening and it goes straight over my head, right? And she'll turn around and say, what did I just say? And I'll try and remember 3-4 times ago when she said something and hope that's the right answer. Generally isn't, then she ends up mad. But that's what happens to the cell when insulin is constantly knocking on it. It eventually loses the signal to hear that insulin is there. Okay? So if insulin stops this, actually what happens when we become insulin resistant is this fat cell continues to liberate free fatty acids into the bloodstream. And this is what we see in type 2 diabetes, high triglycerides and high fatty acids in the bloodstream, but they don't go away and get burnt elsewhere. So this is why lipolysis is important, but it is not by any stretch the only step in burning fat. Remember, we don't burn fat cells. We burn the contents of them. Okay? It is this forever ebb and flow of catabolic versus anabolic state. The guys who want to put on muscle, they just think, I want to be anabolic. I want to put on muscle. Anabolic is also the deposition and the laying down of fat. Okay? So you got to get the balance right. You got to be anabolic when you lift weights. You got to release insulin when you're trying to get nutrients within the cell or when you're trying to get glycogen into muscle cells. You need to be catabolic when you want to burn fat. Okay? And a catabolic state comes across by affecting that energy balance. Now, don't get too bogged down with this. This is where we actually burn fat, okay? So it's called beta oxidation. So it's when these free fatty acids are flowing through our bloodstream and they come into the cell that needs to create energy. So we're energy sparse. There's not much energy available, so we need to create it. Then the cell will uptake this triglyceride. It'll take it to what Ben mentioned, these little powerhouses of the cell called mitochondria. And this is one of the mechanisms where this all goes wrong for a lot of people. If 2 months ago I did a presentation on what's called metabolic flexibility, and it's really simple what it is. It's the ability to be able to swap fuel sources when the demand is needed, okay? To swap from using carbs or glucose to fat for energy. People, when we become unhealthy, when we become overweight, we lose this ability to be able to swap from glucose to fat for fuel. So when the fat gets to the mitochondria, it doesn't uptake it. All right, it doesn't burn it for energy, and we continue to seek out glucose from the bloodstream. So when glucose is low and we can't change to fat, we start to get these big swings in blood sugar. We're totally dictated by our appetite. You always see it in people who can't skip a meal because they fall apart. They get a physical response. They get shaky, lightheaded, hangry, all those things, almost that feeling of drunkenness when they can't uptake fat. So this is the end stage, and we have to be able to get fat within this mitochondria to create what is called the energy substrate of the cell. It's called ATP. Like, carbs and fats directly don't make us energy. They have to get in here to create them. We can create energy elsewhere within the cell, over here, right? We can, but it's really inefficient, and it can only use glucose. And when I spoke about 2 months ago in the metabolic flexibility one, you guys all have the recordings for those. What happens in those kind of circumstances where we've got poor gut health, where we've got poor mitochondrial function, poor immune function, poor blood sugar regulation, all these things will affect the body's ability to be able to effectively get fat in here to create loads of abundance of energy. So yes, energy balance equation for sure. But this is where it all gets nuanced. And this is where some people, a lot of people, need guidance and expertise to be able to weed through this and figure out what the problem is. Why can't you stick to the diet? Maybe it's not a psychological problem. Maybe it's a physical problem where you can't make it from one meal to the next, where you have to have carbohydrates with every meal or you fall apart. Okay, so it does become a little bit more complicated. And this is all, I'm sick to death of speaking about metabolic flexibility, but it's so important for our overall health and our ability to be able to lose fat. So we can see from this, like, step count is important, protein is important. Yes, all the stuff that your coach is telling you. But the ability for you to be able to get fat within the mitochondria, to burn it, will determine your efficiency at losing body fat. Thank you, guys. Now, if anybody has any questions, I am more than happy to sit here and answer them. So you can either chuck it in the chat, or you can just shout out.
Greg, what's indicators of a healthy mitochondria?
What's an indicator of a healthy mitochondria? Good aerobic fitness is a really good sign of good mitochondrial function. So your ability to be able to work at like 130 to 150 beats per minute for long periods of time is normally a good indicator. Good energy production. So people who have low mitochondrial function tend to have poor mood. They tend to have poor brain function is one of them in particular. So when people lose mitochondrial function, it'll be stuff like, here's an example. I used to be able to sit at night and read an entire book cover to cover. Now I read 20 pages and I get tired. That's poor brain mitochondrial function generally, right? So that's a good marker. And then the ability, like we said, to be able to switch from one fuel source to another is going to be a big one. There is markers within a organic acid test, and there is some markers within a standard blood test which can give us indication of mitochondrial function as well. How does gluconeogenesis play into dysfunction, if at all? Good question. So gluconeogenesis is the building, or I shouldn't say the building, the creation of new glucose from something that isn't glucose initially. So glucose can be created from a few different sources, but one of the big ones, remember when I spoke about like the glycerol backbone? That glycerol backbone can go through gluconeogenesis to make new glucose, right? So I would say if we're not liberating fat, well, you're not going to want to create new glucose if you don't need to. So I'm not sure how it leads directly into dysfunction. Greg, can you relate these concepts to the phasic cycle during the day of when your body is accreting tissue and when the body is burning substrate? So that will be fed or fasted state, Gabe. I can get a grasp of what you mean there. So that's going to be fed or fasted state. And that's the shift as we go through times of eating and obviously postprandial. Then you get gaps between meals where you'll go to a catabolic state, then you'll go back to fed, and you'll go back to catabolic states afterwards. So like I said, it's a phasic cycle throughout the day. I hope that's
just
sense.
Nice. Yeah, so Greg, I was just saying, like, it's nice for people to picture, because a lot of people just think I'm always losing fat as long as I'm in a caloric deficit. But then they say, like, when am I losing the fat? And it's really that when the insulin is low, then you're using, you know, fatty acid free available. You know, you're liberating that body fat energy source rather than using substrate. Then you shift into like the anabolic phase of each meal. That was kind of where I was getting at, I guess, if I'm understanding it correctly, maybe the reinforcement of that.
No, like that's a good way of putting it. And the body works well on balances, like it works well on averages as well. So yes, when you're fed, you technically won't be liberating fat. It's a good point. But then as you go through the stages of fasting, you'll be using fat for fuel, and that's when you actually burn it. So Gabe explained it pretty well there. What can you do to boost your mitochondrial function, Devin? So Devin, like normally, we spoke about metabolic flexibility and improving mitochondrial function a few times, but normally I look at aerobic work predominantly in clients. So like you can see mitochondrial or metabolic dysfunction in people when they've got like high resting heart rates, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, and cardio training is a really effective way to start to regulate those things. When we do cardio work, what it does is, within a mitochondria, we get what's called metabolic gridlock. So there's too many substrates within it, so it won't take anything else in. When you do aerobic work and you burn through that, it creates metabolic emergency. So your body wants to then pull in carbohydrates. It wants to pull in fatty acids to create energy to put, I suppose, to put off that emergency, if that makes sense. So normally I start there with aerobic work. Caloric deficit will do it in itself. Lower carbohydrate diets tend to work quite well in those circumstances as well. You can use nutrients like a lot of the B vitamins, alpha lipoic acid, CoQ10. These things will actually aid in making mitochondrial more or have better function, but by themselves would do very little. So if your diet isn't right, if your training isn't right, and you throw a lot of B vitamins on top of it, it will do very little. So start with aerobic work, then correct the diet, and then you can look at nutrients to help as well. I don't know what name that is. Javan?
Oh, hey. Javan? Yeah, my name's Josh. Sorry.
Josh, all right.
You blew my mind there just for a second when you mentioned brain mitochondria. And immediately I thought, like, is it possible to optimize improving your brain mitochondrial function over other areas in your body, or is it universally all the same what you would do?
So I would generally think it's universally all the same. So it's approaching it in the same way. Now, there has been like, so when we look at like L-carnitine, which I actually didn't mention, which I should have, L-carnitine is the amino acid that is responsible. It's an enzyme as well, carnitine acyl transferase. Is responsible for getting fatty acids out of the bloodstream and helping to pull them in the mitochondria. Acetyl L-carnitine, I'm sure, has been shown to be much more beneficial for brain mitochondria as a supplement. But in general, I would be looking at a whole body approach to improving brain mitochondria as well. Like at the very extreme end of correcting, not necessarily brain chemistry, but brain mitochondria, like ketogenic diets have been shown to be really, really effective, but that's the very extreme end of it. Lower carbohydrates could be just as beneficial for what you're looking for. Okay, Russell, metabolic dysfunction and emotional mental dysfunction, such as depression or high stress or anxiety, can each be the cause of the other? Yes, so that's the chicken or egg argument, right? So, yeah, no problem, Josh. I'll get onto you in a sec. That's the chicken or egg question, right? So what causes depression? Is it a psychological stressor that leads on then to a physiological stressor that just compound each other? Or is it metabolic dysfunction that leads on to brain dysfunction? And that's the inflammatory theory of depression. So there's a lot of studies out there showing that, like, if you challenge, they obviously can't do it in humans, right? But if you challenge primates with a real big inflammatory response, they tend to show symptoms of depression, anxiety, and all these things, and they withdraw from society. It's called sickness behavior, right? So there's definitely a component of physical health in psychological health, right? That is definitely for sure. But it's definitely a blend of both. So what triggers it initially, we don't know. But we know that those with post-traumatic stress syndrome, for example, have physical problems outside of the brain. So it's it's one leading into the other. Josh, do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, okay. So let's say most of us here are, you know, in Toronto time at 6:45. We've had a busy day. We've been given, or like Ben's saying, I'll be honest with you, I'm sitting here, I'm like, I'm just kind of tired. Like, I love the topic, but like, my eyes are getting tired. You made me think about the brain energy, mitochondria. So when we're tired right now, and it's only 6:45, and I just ate a post-workout meal before this, you know, everything's balanced and exactly what I needed. Is it a mitochondrial issue then right now, just feeling tired? Or is it just like, hey, I should just wrap up the day and try to fall asleep in the next hour? Because I've been up since five.
Right. So you've been up since five. So it's probably a good marker as well. Like, I think Ben made a good point when he initially kicked off the call, where he discussed, like, so it's not, that wouldn't always necessarily just be a mitochondria problem. That can just be sleep debt. So the buildup of adenosine in the brain, where you're actually just getting to the stage of the night where you're responding to the darkness outside and you're getting tired. Right. It's a natural process as well. So although mitochondrial creates energy, sleep debt within the brain will make you tired. Now, I can't actually tell, like, obviously right now what the problem for you is. Ben Bukulski, light cortisol, melatonin, adenosine. Yeah, like there's loads of different things. From a really hard working day, you should be tired in the evening.
Yeah. Up since five, workout, busy with all clients and staff and stuff like that. So. And now, but I want that energy, like Ben's saying, you know what I mean? It's like, I want to keep going until, but I guess we got to know when to put the brakes on, like Ben was saying.
So Josh, I'll say this, like you can ride the energy wave longer and learning. You can learn how to hack it, right? You can learn how to time certain things throughout the day, like timing your light exposure, timing your caffeine intake, timing your workouts, timing your meals, increasing your light exposure later in the day if you want to extend it. There's definitely ways you can. However, if you get too much light, if you front load everything in the day, like the workout, the light, the food, if it's front loaded, you're going to get tired earlier. So your best hack, if you want to push it back, is maybe like you don't eat for the first 3 hours of the day and, you know, get a bunch of light exposure, but maybe it's like 2 hours after you wake. It's like, it's not everything right front loaded in the day. You're just trying to shift your circadian biology 2 hours in another direction.
Yeah, not related to mitochondrial dysfunction necessarily.
Well, it directly influences mitochondrial function. It's not necessarily dysfunction. So like light is massively influencing your mitochondrial function. So is cortisol, so is melatonin. So yes, it's directly influencing your cortisol. So think of everything like working on a clock. So if I'm getting this light exposure, my body starts producing cortisol because it says, hey, it's light. I'm supposed to be awake. Cortisol stimulates the mitochondria to produce more energy. So that it does work in the mitochondria, but it may not be dysfunction per se.
Agreed. Okay. Thanks, guys.
I hope that helps, brother. John McBrien. There he is. I've tried some of the supplements containing deer antler velvet extract. It's supposed to boost HGH. Do I notice that it does provide an energy boost and little else? Do you know anything about this stuff? I'm also dealing with thyroid failure issues. So yeah, like, don't get me wrong. When people are dealing with a thyroid issue, weight loss does become more difficult. It doesn't necessarily mean that weight loss is impossible, right? It's important to remember that as well. It will be slower. You may need to be slightly more aggressive in terms of your approach to weight loss. In regards to, I've never heard of deer antler velvet extract. Like, boosting HGH, will it have a consistent and substantial influence on fat loss? Probably not like you would expect it to. Now, sleep can boost HGH quite significantly as well, and can be really, really beneficial. But I wouldn't necessarily think that a slight boost in HGH would have a big influence on your weight loss. Now, getting obviously thyroid under control and whatever processes you're going through with your doctor would be really beneficial for that as well.
I could talk to GH a little bit.
Yeah, probably better actually.
Yeah. So people always think GH is this really big lever because it's so expensive. It's going to do all this stuff. It really doesn't. The greatest benefit you'll receive from growth hormone supplementation exogenously is actually not necessarily fat loss. It's muscle retention. So in my experience, in my opinion, the greatest time to use growth hormone is when you're going to be in periods of extended caloric deficit to retain muscle. It helps retain collagenous tissue, helps heal the joints, heal the bones, joints more than bones. But as far as fat loss, very, very small lever. It is a lever, but it's a small lever.
That helps.
Interesting topic right there.
Is there a way to determine sluggish thyroid without doing specific blood panels, Josh? You can use biofeedback, which can be beneficial, I suppose, in certain circumstances. Like, people will talk about like the standard symptoms like cold hands and feet. You'll generally find in more so in females with thyroid issues where they'll start to lose the hair in their parting. Like, obviously, you'll notice like sluggish mood, inability to lose fat. It's not as common a thing as you'll find a lower body temperature as well. It's not as common a thing to find in males as it is in females. And the exact mechanism, I know it's based around estrogen, but I can't exactly remember off the top of my head. So there is a few ways, but the problem with stuff like cold hands and feet is that could be a nitric oxide problem. That could be a circulation problem as well. So blood panels for a thyroid are not expensive. The only problem with something like a thyroid and a test is, like hormones, they can be fleeting. So what's the average? Like, it's something like, to diagnose an underactive thyroid in most females takes 6 to 8 years of testing, because you could walk in on a good day and your thyroid hormone looks fine, when realistically it's underactive, right? So it can be really difficult to diagnose. So like, you can look at some of those symptoms, but it's not as common as it would be in men. That's a good one, actually. What do you find the biggest lever holding back the group is respect to fat loss? Well, I suppose if we talk physiologically, good question. Actually, I'll put that out to some of the coaches. Coaches, what do you think the biggest lever that people are missing?
Is discipline.
Okay.
I'll answer. So, guys, here's the... If we went like order of operations as far as priorities, the biggest thing holding people back is inconsistency, for sure. Yeah. If you're not consistent with your diet and your training, it's impossible to predict. So a lot of people are doing is they're kind of sporadic. They're kind of all over the place with their diet, kind of all over the place with their training. What I tried to create, and what you should try to create, is Groundhog Day. If you can eat the same calories and do the relative same caloric expenditure workouts every day, it creates predictability. And predictability is great in terms of the body, because the body gets into rhythms, the body gets into cycles, and then you just make slight tweaks, slight subtractions in calories, slight additions in output, and the body changes. So I would say that's the first biggest mistake people are making, not being consistent. So pick a caloric number and hit it every day. You don't need to cycle. You don't need to do 10 hours of cardio. Just hit the caloric number every day. Your body will stabilize. when your body stabilizes, you go, okay, well, what should I do? Do I want to lose weight? Yes, pull a little bit of calories out, or not both, or increase expenditure. Start there. So that then the question, the follow-up question is, well, what are the biggest levers? It really doesn't matter at that point. It's like you can kind of do whichever you want. And some people will have a limit, like Greg was saying, some people have a limiting factor in some of these coenzymes and cofactors like B vitamins and magnesium and CoQ10 that are factors in fat loss or maybe insulin dysregulation. But until you kind of stabilize calories and say, hey, like this is where I am, it's very hard to make a change. Now, I'm not saying that caloric cycling doesn't work because it does, but it needs to be, in my opinion, stabilized first, create some semblance of predictability and, like I said, Groundhog Day. And then later on in a more advanced circumstance, does something like caloric cycling work? And also just kind of dovetailing off what Craig said, the biggest lever in sustainable fat loss is your aerobic fitness. I would say aerobic anaerobic fitness. Obviously muscle building is a massive one, but like if your aerobic fitness is crap, which, and I always say that because most people's anaerobic fitness is crap, your likelihood of building muscle is going to be significantly less.
Chris, did you have one?
Just to piggyback off, if I look at the data I have of the people who get the best results versus no results or limited results, it's the consistency of doing the same thing. It's like Ben said, it's Groundhog Day. Any athlete that excels at a sport goes the same amount of practices every week, does the extra stuff on their own, sleeps the same, plays the same. Anyone in fitness, the same thing. If you want to gain weight and get out of shape, you do the same thing every day. You eat too much, you eat the wrong things, and you don't exercise. So just do that long enough and you go one way. You got to do the opposite to go in the other way. It's the consistency that leads to that. Find what you can do and then lean on that.
I think Matt's made a good point in the chat. He said, like, people who say, like, they want to intuitively make healthy choices. I can say it's backed up by science, and it's very clear anecdotally, we are shit at predicting the amount of food that we intake. So bad at it. So they did a study on it. What was it? So the general population underestimate the amount of food they eat by 50%. Nutritionists and dietitians underestimate the amount of food that they eat by 30%. So we suck at intuitive eating. Some people can do it after really long periods of time, but it's hard, man. Dom?
Are you saying to always use a scale to measure the macros?
I would say initially, right? I would say definitely initially to figure out where you stand. Like, don't get me wrong, you'll get to that stage where you can look at a piece of chicken and you can guess within, then you can guess within 10% where it is, right? Quite comfortably. But at the very beginning, I do like people to use scales because it gives them a really, like you said, like Andrew said, one tablespoon of peanut butter is depressing to look at, right? So if you actually measure these things correctly, you're going to realize how much you were actually over consuming before. Dumb.
So yeah, Josh's question, it made me think of like people with ADHD and that stuff and mitochondria. So what's the spiel about that?
So like with brain function and ADHD. So what you find with a lot of people with ADHD is they fail to use glucose particularly well anyway. So they don't produce enough energy within the brain, which gives them that hyperactive feeling. Now, there's loads of other aspects to this as well, Dom, and I can go through this with you in more detail for sure if you ever want to. But one of the other thing is they actually fail to get blood flow to the brain very effectively. So when you look at like supplements like pycnogenol has been shown to be very effective at regulating stuff like ADHD, but like they tend to respond a lot worse to blood sugar intake. So they get much bigger blood sugar spikes and much bigger blood sugar depression. So they struggle to regulate consistent energy, because you know if I said this correct, throughout the day. So that's one of the components. There is loads more. I'd be happy to go through with you, Dom, if you ever want to jump on a call.
Definitely. I will probably do that in a couple of weeks. So
give me a message. Oh, yeah. So yeah, unfortunately, many people are, Chris makes a good point. Many people are overestimating how hard they actually train. because and you see it regularly. Once you get a video from someone, and it is one of our pet peeves as coaches, is people who don't send us videos, because we can tell you if you're working hard or not. Most people are really bad at judging their work ethic within the gym. So not necessarily ethic, but how far they think they're pushing it.
Let's make this blanket statement: you're not training hard. You're just fucking not. Like, and that's gonna hurt people's feelings, but it's true. Like, and the reason I say that, not to be crude and say that I am, but to say that there's five more gears that you just don't know how to access. So as you're in the gym, your conversation with yourself is, how do I access those gears? And so the question you ask yourself every set is, why did I stop? Why did I stop? And here's the thing, you don't, Russ, let's go, man. You don't have to make every set, balls out, laying on the floor, puking failure, but you should try to get there at least once a workout, right? And then maybe it's once an exercise, you know? And so one of the most effective strategies I use for guys who don't train hard is, I'm like, hey man, you only get one set for this exercise today. You don't get four, you get one. I'm like, what do you mean? And the first week, the workout's shit and they're pissed off. I'm like, yeah, next week, you still get one. So guess what happens the next week? They lean in a little bit. They work a little harder. After 4 or 5 weeks of only getting one set per exercise, they finally realize, like, I better get my head out of my ass or I'm not going to get the results I want. And people start creating urgency. And then once you've created some work, then you add a second set back in. It's a bit of a process, but it's very effective. That's a good point Josh just made there. He has to be careful how hard he pushes in the gym, because stress is so high everywhere else. So that's an important thing to bring up. And one of the things I will tell you guys, if the stress of the gym isn't the biggest stress in your life, you're not going to build muscle maximally. That's guaranteed. The muscle building stress has to be the biggest stress. However, I think I said right when I started this call, I did. If you can sleep at the end of this day, you're probably okay to push the stress. You may not build muscle because you have so much sympathetic drive and so much cortisol driving catabolic pathways. You probably need an excess of calories or an increase in calories. So if you have more sympathetic drive, more breakdown, more stress, you simply need to eat more food. It needs to be there. I think I would say you need to train more often. So not necessarily more volume, Josh, but more often, because you want to flip that anabolic signal more often, right? Because the catabolic signal from stress, you want to kind of make sure your body's always getting into that muscle building, like turn the anabolic signal on in the muscle tissue, I would say. Shorter volume or shorter duration, more greater frequency.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense.
Forgive the misspellings.
Anyone else have questions for Greg or for anybody else? Hey guys, well, we want to be respectful of your time. We always wrap this call up at 7 o'clock. So guys, thank you for being here. If any of those people who are, see you, Russ. Who are new to the group, want to stick around later. We'll talk to you guys a little bit about how to put together a muscle plan, answer any of your specific questions. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate you being here, guys. Greg, phenomenal presentation, man. That was very, yeah. Very simple and very, very
really good.
Yep. Very, very good.
Thank you, guys.
Good job.
Appreciate that.
For sure. For the work, man. A lot of information most people can't even comprehend. And that's the inside stuff that the common man just doesn't get. But it's hard to believe that people actually, you're speaking languages that most people won't understand. I'm not even sure if it's even functional for the average person, but, it's good info, man. I think the science behind what you're, it's so deep. You take an average guy who's working 2-3 years at the gym, and you speak the language and the lexicon and the terminology that you guys come up with now, with from cell mitochondria and all that, and insulin and sensitivity.